The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And what a great day in the markets. I mean, the Dow Jones is up over 200 points. It is now approaching 35,000. Markets are soaring, whereas new jobs are not. They were flat. They were wildly underperforming what the Biden administration had predicted, what everybody had assumed would happen. What the beep is going on? I mean, honest to goodness, why are markets up so much and so sharply, setting new records at the same time that there's evidence that there are lots and lots of Americans who could get jobs because the job market is really tight? You saw what the governor of Montana did. We talked about it yesterday, is basically trying to take away some federal unemployment guarantees. Why is it that there are people who are sitting at home who had jobs once upon a time, who could have jobs right now, certainly, but they aren't going for it? Governor Ron DeSantis, who has really developed a knack for inserting himself into every newsworthy development, has comments on that. He says, normally when you're getting unemployment, the whole idea is that's temporary and you need to be looking for work to be able to get off unemployment. It was a disaster. So we suspended those job search requirements. I think it's pretty clear now we have an abundance of job openings. Well, we do. So what's keeping people from getting those jobs and going after those jobs? We will get to that on the Michael Medved Show. We'll also be talking to Frank Buckley, who says that part of the problem in America is we lack a virtue that our forefathers, that earlier generations of this country had in spades. The virtue was curiosity. And he talks about rules that should be generated from the need to be intellectually curious. And also, he says something we need to do before 4th of July is a fourth turning, as the only way Republicans can possibly win in the future. We will get to that. We will get to the great buckwheat debate. No, this is incredible. It's actually sad, and it's also hilarious. There was an ongoing debate in a state legislature where one of the legislators used the term buckwheat, which is, I think it's kind of a racial slur. So what are the consequences and what is his approach? He will explain all that to us. And speaking of racial slurs, there's a lawsuit out in Indiana, a federal lawsuit, federal, to get the federal government involved because a lady says that her house was appraised for less than it's really worth because she had Afrocentric decorations in her home that identified her as a person of color. Could this lawsuit actually explain or account for a $100,000 appraisal difference? We will get to that. And there are a bunch of new movies today, including a really fun, touching family film about the robot apocalypse. No, I'm not kidding. It's animated. And another stunning documentary about high levels of secret foreign policy, plus a new Jason Statham thriller and much more. All coming up on a big day on the Michael Medved Show. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. Okay, first up, the question of where we stand with COVID-19. Now, everybody may be a little bit tired. I mean, aren't we all? Of lockdowns and restrictions and dealing with this pandemic. And of course, I am too. Everybody is. But if you read the Wall Street Journal International report, more than 1.4 million COVID-19 deaths have been reported in the first 4 months of this year. That's as the virus has torn through Latin America, and swaths of Asia, according to official tallies compiled at the University of Oxford. Recorded deaths are rising by about 13,000 a day. The virus's toll looks set within weeks to surpass the 1.8 million deaths recorded for 2020. In other words, the international death rate that we're looking at now is going to be about double in the first part of 2021 as it was in the first part of 2020. India continues to set world records in new cases. And they write from Nepal and Iran to Uruguay and Argentina, health systems are buckling as patients swamp hospitals, compounding the disease's deadly toll. In some countries, oxygen is running low, and intensive care units are brimming. Crematoriums are running full tilt. New variants of the virus are advancing faster than overworked labs contract them. Okay, this is not over. Churchill is famous for saying this is not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end. It is perhaps the end of the beginning. Maybe we are past the end of the beginning. Maybe we are looking at the beginning of the end, but it's not the end, and it's certainly not the end in America. And why would it be that there are 30% of Americans who simply do not plan to get a vaccine, which, of course, kills our chances of herd immunity, which kills our chances of actually making the United States safe from what President Trump used to call the invisible enemy. 1-800-955-1776. If you yourself refuse to get the vaccine or don't plan to get the vaccine, or if you know people who don't plan to get the vaccine, what's the thinking here? There's a piece in The Atlantic recently about people and their vaccine resistance, and it's a good piece by Derek Thompson, who spoke to more than a dozen people who were simply refusing to get a COVID-19 vaccine. Now, of course, it's free. It's now relatively easy. The difficulties in getting the vaccine are not that difficult. And he said that the people who he spoke to, who were vaccine resistors, if you will, were not especially vulnerable. That was the most common argument. I'm a young person. I am not elderly. I don't have any comorbidities. I'm really not vulnerable. Sometimes there are people who believe that they had already gotten the virus. And then there are people who say, okay, I could get it in the future, but it won't be that bad. I know people who've had it. It's not that big a deal. Why should I take a risk on a, quote, experimental vaccine? And the answer is because we're in this together. There's a powerful piece today by David Brooks in the New York Times. And he says, could today's version of America have been able to win World War II? It hardly seems possible. Victory in World War II required national cohesion, voluntary sacrifice for the common good, and trust in institutions and each other. America's response to COVID-19 suggests that we can no longer have sufficient quantities of any of these things. In 2020, Americans failed to actually distance and test for the coronavirus and suffered among the highest infection and death rates in the developed world. Millions decided that wearing a mask infringed their individual liberty. This week, the New York Times has reported that experts now believe that America will not achieve herd immunity anytime soon. Instead of largely beating this disease, it could linger for generations. A major reason is that about 30% of the U.S. population is reluctant to get vaccinated. What's that about? What do we do about it?
Want me to discuss with you, you have to calm down first.
This
are you calm?
Is the Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, talking about the resistance to vaccines, there was a Gallup poll we covered yesterday, international Gallup poll, that showed that around the world, there are more than 1.3 billion people who are currently refusing to get vaccines. There are countries where the overwhelming majority refuse to get vaccines. What's it all about? It's about a lack of social trust, basically thinking that people are out to get you, that the government is evil. Now, of course, a lot of these countries where the majority of people refuse to get vaccines, the government is evil and is not to be trusted. Is it appropriate to feel that way about the United States? Let's go to Kirsten in Tacoma, Washington. Kirsten, you're on the Medved Show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I was telling
you,
screener, I've decided that I've put these people into three different categories. I think the first category are the people who are just anti-vaxxers. They don't want any vaccine. I think they're a small minority. Then I think there's a larger group of people who have gotten vaccinated for most other things, but for whatever reason, they are reluctant to take this particular vaccine. And I think that's the group that the government, if they were, would change their messaging, might be able to reach. And I do think that a lot of that falls into the distrust category. And then the third group, I think, are the people who, unfortunately, the vaccine, like every other aspect of this pandemic, has been politicized. And I feel that there are a group of people who, for whom the more the government pushes them into it, the more resistant they're going to be. And I'm not sure that they're going to be effective reaching that group either, unless that group, you know, happens to have somebody in their family or somebody they know who gets very sick or dies from coronavirus, then they'll probably run out and get a vaccine. But I think the more those people are pushed, the more they're going to resist. But I do think the government has done a very poor job messaging as to why people should be getting vaccinated.
Yeah, you said that regarding group two. By the way, I think your analysis is very smart, but you said the government should change its messaging. How? What do you think the government should be saying differently?
I think they're killing their own cause. When you tell people that you're fully vaccinated, but yet you still need to wear masks, and that isn't just vaccinated people walking among unvaccinated people. I know for a fact, I know a woman who works with a group, and I mean, they want a room of fully vaccinated people to still be wearing masks. And you have to start asking yourself, what is this about? That doesn't feel like it's about a virus anymore. So I think they're killing their own cause. It gives people the impression that either there's no confidence, that the government has no confidence in the vaccine, or that, again, they just want to control you because they know that vaccinated people really aren't likely to spread the virus. But if they tell us, oh, yeah, vaccinated people, go ahead and take off your mask, then the unvaccinated people will also take off their masks, which is probably true. But at some point, I think we have to be able to move on and we have to say, look, we have a safe and effective vaccine. We want people to take it. We hope they take it, but we're moving on. Businesses should not be shut down. Schools should not be shut down. And I shouldn't have to wear a mask forever because there's this minority of the population that has decided they don't want to take a vaccine.
I think you're exactly right. And that's very well said. And thank you for your contribution to the conversation. I agree with you on virtually every point. There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal today about how Biden could actually help the vaccine process enormously. And he clearly wants to. It's something he wants to do, and it's something that's in the national interest. If he would make it clear that once you get vaccinated, you can have the world open up to you, which you can. I mean, for us, I've said this on the air before, we're now in my family, we're all fully vaccinated, all the adults. The little kids, they say, and I think that's right, they don't really need vaccine if people around them are vaccinated and prepared and ready. And one of the things that I think is terrific is to encourage people, as David Brooks was doing in this column today. This is really a matter of the nation pulling together. And what he says is, he says, we're not asking you to storm the beaches of Iwo Jima. We're asking you to walk into a damn CVS. Americans have always been an individualistic people, he writes, who don't like being told what to do, just as Kirsten said accurately. But in times of crisis, they have historically still had the capacity to form what de Tocqueville called a social body, a coherent community capable of collective action. During World War I, for example, millions served at home and abroad to win a faraway war, responding to recruiting posters that read, I want you and Americans all. That basic sense of peoplehood, he writes, of belonging to a common enterprise with a shared destiny, is exactly what's lacking today. Researchers and reporters who talk to the vaccine hesitant find that the levels of distrust, suspicion, and alienation that have marred politics are now threatening the vaccination process. They find people who doubt the competence of the medical establishment or any establishment, who assume as a matter of course that their fellow countrymen are out to con, deceive, and harm them. And this is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if, in fact, we cannot make a final turn around the bend and get to that herd immunity situation where the pandemic really is retreating, it isn't gaining ground or holding steady, it's going away. It's dissipating. That's what we all want. We can't do that if a third of the people are refusing to get vaccinated. And yet the problem is that when we don't do that, when we continue to have problems, when we continue to have people going to hospitals and high rates of infection, et cetera, then people are saying, oh, see what they told us all along about the vaccine being the answer for everything. And it kind of is. That was not true. You can't trust them. I mean, honestly, this is a very real problem. It's one of the problems we'll talk about with Frank Buckley, who F.H. Buckley is a professor of law at George Mason University, a dedicated conservative. And he's written a recent column that says the only way that Republicans can win in 2022 and 2024 is with what he calls the fourth turning. What is that? And why is curiosity so important for the American character or the American future? We'll be right back with F.H. Buckley here on The Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, in the midst of the Biden administration, it's fairly obvious that conservatives are united about wanting to stand against some of the irresponsible spending and the expansion of the welfare state and the intrusion of government into every aspect of our lives. But what's the best way to counteract it? What's the best way to cope with the initiatives that Joe Biden has been, some would believe, pushed into putting before the American people, pushed by the likes of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, et cetera, et cetera. There's a thinker and writer and law professor who's a friend of mine named F.H. Buckley, who has written a new book that says one of the key tools in any kind of conservative revival, or for that matter, survival in the United States, is curiosity. He's written a new book. It's called Curiosity and Its 12 Rules for Life. I know it sounds like a self-help book. It's not. It's much more than that. Frank Buckley, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Hey, Michael, it's great to talk to you again.
Oh, thank you. Tell me how you would apply the crucial lessons of Curiosity, your new book, and we've posted it at our website at michaelmedved.com. How would you apply that to the challenges that Republicans and conservatives face right now?
Well, I think, first of all, to coin a phrase, I think it's important to kind of tune out from the craziness. And there's craziness on both sides, honestly, right?
Absolutely.
Apart from that, we've been stuck inside our homes during the COVID pandemic. And then we were told it's immoral to think about anything other than social justice. And, you know, in a way, we've been brainwashed. And, you know, we've been told that groupthink is obligatory. You tend to fall into a rut. And inconvenient people and thought we're supposed to put into a trash folder. And you know, and that's just wrong. Right. And the, you know, one way out, the principal way out is to be curious about the things that are shut aside. Okay. And the book, it offers 12 rules. They're not rules. They're really stories about people we admire. And what we admire about people is basically how they were curious and how they, for that reason, took risks, how they learned how to entertain other people. I say curiosity is the basis of morality and religion. You know, that's going to be the way back. And it's basically a way of telling people who are essentially ordering us into a rut to say, no, life's more complicated than that, right? There are other things that matter.
Absolutely. One of the things that's very, very striking about your book is the subtitle is Curiosity and its 12 Rules for Life. And rule number one is don't make rules.
Yeah,
why
right.
Why is it important not to make rules?
Well, the point about not making rules is rules constrain you, and sometimes the restraints make sense and they're self-imposed. But the pure rule follower is a machine man, right? You know, he's got this simple program. He'll simply follow it, and life demands more of us than that. You know, if that's all there is, we don't really need a personality. We just need the rule book. Well, you know, that's not how to get through life. Life requires flexibility, and that's going to take curiosity about all the other things that are out there.
This brings me to a column. You're a regular columnist for American Spectator, and as I mentioned before, a distinguished professor of law at George Mason University at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. You recently wrote about what you call the fourth turning and the importance of what you call progressive conservatism, which strikes many people as a contradiction in terms, as the only way that Republicans are going to win future elections, combining pro-Trump people with anti-Trump people, with people who don't care about Trump, to go beyond that to some kind of fusion ticket that emphasizes the key principles of the Republican Party historically. What is progressive conservatism?
Well, I have a nostalgia for an older Republican Party, which is the party of Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and Eisenhower. And it's a party that one could feel proud of belonging to, right? It was indeed the noble party in American politics for 100 years. And we've taken wrong turns, and we want to reverse that. In part, there was a correction associated with Trumpism, if not Trump, right, which was a remembrance of people left behind, namely the deplorables, right? And so I'd like the party to go back to that. You know, remember Eisenhower was the civil rights president of the time. And he was a person who made his peace with the New Deal and the welfare state. Well, that's what Americans want. And so a revived Republican Party would, you know, leave the crazies to go their own way, but retain that which was admirable in a reach out to people left behind. and would embrace things like catastrophic health insurance, for example, things all Americans want. So that kind of republicanism is properly called progressive at a time when the progressives around here seem like anything but progressive.
Okay, in terms of all of the current battles in the political world, there are a number of them that are crucial, some that we actually, it seems to me, are likely to win. Do you share the general sentiment that it is absolutely essential to fight to maintain the filibuster in the Senate, to fight to avoid court packing, for instance, some of the more structural changes that Democrats are pushing?
There are two separate things. I don't get so worked up about the filibuster. Remember, that's a two-edged sword, right, as the Democrats discovered when they gave up the filibuster over judicial appointments. So, I like the idea of being able to reverse bad ideas, and that's easier when you don't have a filibuster. But as for other stuff, right, court packing or admitting new states, that would just blow things up. I mean, at that point, heaven knows where we'd go after that. I mean, that would rip the shreds of that which binds us together as a country, you know, and secession would become more likely as a consequence. That is so inconsistent with the idea that we're a people who plays by the regular rules, that I fear the country would be torn apart if we went in that direction.
I say amen to that. And the new book, Curiosity and its 12 Rules for Life, one of the things that's so entertaining about reading it is it's not just about political ideas or even about history. You learn all kinds of things about philosophers, his favorite movies. I don't fully share your enthusiasm for Jules and Jim, by the way. His favorite movies, music, and much more, because F.H. Buckley illustrates the virtue that he extols in the book, that virtue, curiosity. This is a man with a curious and expansive mind, and I hope you'll join us again on the show soon. The book is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com, and it's entertaining and eye-opening reading for anybody who can take the time with it. When we come back, we will get to a range of issues, more on this issue about losing our trust for one another and therefore putting at risk our national unity and our ability to cope effectively with the COVID-19 virus. There's also a lawsuit, which when you read it, it doesn't sound entirely ridiculous, saying that a housing appraisal of somebody, a homeowner who wants to sell a house, was impacted based on racism. We'll get to that and more coming up on The MedVed Show.
Entertain your brain.
Americans are going to hear the truth.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, still talking about what is one of the big stories of the day. The other big story of the day, it seems to me, is the job numbers, which are actually very discouraging, and yet the market seems to like it fine. We'll explain why the market likes it and why there actually is some action needed by the Biden administration to deal with these job numbers, which are so far below, I mean, so dramatically far below what we were led to expect. Okay, part of the problem that we're facing right now, and it seems to me that this has to do with the job numbers as well, is, first of all, there's still schools that need to open up. There are still restrictions that are applied to people in terms of operating their businesses. We haven't finished with the COVID-19 problem. And right now we're in a situation in most states in the union where we have more vaccines available than there are arms willing to accept those vaccines. And David Brooks writes, I think, a very persuasive piece that says that, look, what is missing here is a sense of national unified purpose. The idea that it's an American thing. It's not just a Democratic thing. It's not just a liberal thing. It's not just a moderate thing. It's not just a conservative thing. It's everybody. Everybody has a stake in getting most of the people in the country, everybody we can, vaccinated and safer. And again, the government is spending, and this is not controversial, the government is spending a great deal of money trying to get this message out. And the answer is not to shame other people, because that just makes the situation worse. What David Brooks writes, and I think he's right on this, is the causes of this isolation and distrust are as plentiful as there are stars in the heavens. But there are a few things we can say. Most of the time, distrust is earned distrust. Trust levels in any society tend to be reasonably accurate representations of how trustworthy that society has been. That's why the nations of the world where you have not 30% of people resisting vaccines, but upwards of 70% of people resisting vaccines, are nations with very untrustworthy governments. Governments that are hideously corrupt, that are dictatorial, that are vastly worse than the American government at its very worst, and that leave some questions about, well, how can you trust somebody in Kazakhstan, for instance, which has, they are only 25% of people in Kazakhstan who said they'd ever consider getting a vaccine. Overall majority say wouldn't even consider it. So trust levels in any society, he writes, tend to be reasonably accurate representations of how trustworthy that society has been. Trust in the main, in trust is the ratio, he says, of the times someone has shown up for you versus the time somebody has betrayed you. Marginalized groups tend to be the most distrustful for good reasons. They've been betrayed. And this has to do with the fact that, for instance, Black Americans are much less likely to have received the vaccine or to have sought out the vaccine, because there's a history, and people always point to the Tuskegee experiment, of distrusting the medical establishment, because 50 years ago and more, it was deeply, deeply racist. I don't believe that is the case anymore, especially with a proliferation of Black doctors and nurses everywhere. In any event, he goes on and he says marginalized people tend to be the most distrustful. The other thing is to say is that once it is established, distrust tends to accelerate. If you distrust the people around you because you think they have bad values or they're out to hurt you, then you're going to be slow to reach out to solve common problems. Your problems will have a tendency to get worse, which seems to justify and then magnify your distrust. You have entered a distrust doom loop. That, by the way, would be a good title for a book, don't you think? The Distrust Doom Loop. He says, our pathetic COVID response may not be the last or worst consequence of this condition. He then writes, the New Deal was an act of social solidarity that created the national cohesion we needed to win World War II. I am not in the habit of supporting massive federal spending proposals, but in this specific context, in the midst of a distrust doom loop, this may be our best shot of reversing the decline. But not to pass the Biden agenda the way he's presented it. To actually get together and devise some kinds of helping programs that can actually make a real difference for people. And that doesn't necessarily mean going forward with $6 trillion of additional spending where they don't even realize where it's going to be prioritized, when that spending includes $80 billion for Amtrak, for instance. Foolishness. And then there's this. I originally picked out this story, and I was considering it for a dumb lawsuit. And then I looked at it more, and okay, I'm going to turn away from distrust on this because this sounds like it might be a legit complaint. The story from WISH-TV, that's Channel 8 in Indianapolis, says a black Indianapolis woman says she was racially discriminated against while getting her home appraised in 2020. An early appraisal came in at $149,000 less than the final one. Why? Because the first appraisal, she hadn't done anything special to get her house ready. And in the final one, she staged the home with a white friend standing in for her and staging it in a way that it would look like a white home rather than a black home. Now, what does that mean? With help from the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana, she filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The neighborhood around Indiana Avenue, which is where the home is historically a black neighborhood. Carlette Duffy's grandparents and other black people started settling there generations ago. And she said she wanted to purchase her grandparents' home primarily because it was very close to my house, and I was hoping that at some point my daughter and granddaughter could live there. Sounds like an admirable thing to want. So she was going to refinance her current home, get it appraised for as much as she could, borrow as much as she could, so she could buy her grandparents' home. That's a great American story. Her plan was to refinance her remodeled home, take the extra money, and buy her grandparents' home. But Duffy was unable to make that happen. I just felt like I needed to fight it. I felt like I had to say something. And that's when I reported it to one of the state agencies. And here are just some of the details. Duffy says her personal research put her home's value at about $185,000. But an initial appraisal valued it at only $125,000. A second valued it at $110,000. So she had an idea. Maybe I should whitewash my home and see what happens. After leaving her race off the paperwork, removing all family photos, some African artwork that she had on the wall, and she staged a guest room as a yoga studio. Okay, I think the assumption here is that a house with a yoga studio is much more likely a white home, she thinks, than a black home, maybe. She also had a white friend stand in for her. In other words, when the appraiser came, the white friend said, oh, I'm the homeowner. And then the third appraisal went up from $125,000 and $110,000 to $259,000. Duffy said she's doing her part to show the next generation that no one has to simply take whatever is given. Now, with this investigation, I am sure that the people who are responsible for these appraisals were not thinking immediately in racist terms. Oh, this is a black family. We have to. And it's very possible that in restaging the house, who knows, maybe her white friend who helped her restage the house had a better idea for effective staging. But is it possible that racism is a part of this? It seems to me that it very clearly is. It's a fascinating case, and we will follow it. More coming up about charges, or at least claims, that the early Christians were socialists. Is that even true? We will get to that in this greatest nation on God's green earth.